It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. What is the mental picture that you get when you think of what a scientist is? A man or a woman in a white coat in front of a Bunsen burner or a microscope? It might not be the sexiest image or a truly representative one either. As our guest Jason Brown will attest, he's the director of science and education at Carnegie Science Center. He spoke to Congress last week about an initiative to help schools evaluate and expand the way they teach math and science. As part of our Life of Learning initiative, he joins us now in Studio A. Jason Brown, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
You say there are millions of practicing STEM professionals who do not fit that aforementioned stereotype. Who are they, and what are they doing?
Well, in terms of STEM education, there are people from across the sectors. STEM education goes well beyond the idea of just an engineer or a scientist in the white coat and the Bunsen burner. In fact, over 50% of the open STEM jobs in the region and nationally don't require even a four-year degree. So STEM professionals can be not only the engineers and the scientists, but they can be the surveyors, the construction professionals, the welders. It's a very wide range because the STEM skills that are required for those jobs are problem-solving skills. It's not necessarily science content knowledge.
So you spoke to Congress last week, and the politicians like Congressman Keith Rothfuss are telling us there are a lot of jobs available in STEM-related fields, as you just mentioned. His examples are health and computer technicians, that they can graduate with associate degrees, they can earn an annual salary of $60,000, which certainly is not a bad thing. It's a practical goal, but I guess a lot of us who are enamored with science and who don't grasp it as well as others do, think of it as a field where people really think big. Is this thinking big? Should we be thinking big, or should we adjust our thinking?
Well, I think we can still think big, but it needs to be more inclusive. The idea of the scientist, again, is not just the cutting-edge research in astronomy or in healthcare, but we need to adapt our vision and shift the paradigm a little bit so that we understand that it takes a wider breadth of society to move these innovations forward. Not only are there the thinkers, but there are the doers. So there are people in all facets of science or engineering or however you'd like to describe it that are responsible for completing pieces of this.
So the stereotypical image of the scientist, it really isn't that bad of a thing necessarily. We're just trying to maybe get away from it or make sure people understand it's not the only image. It's not the only idea that there is out there.
Well, no, but the idea of – I think people are attracted to positions where they can relate. So if you are not the stereotypical white man in the lab coat, and you may not be as interested in science. If you are if you see someone who thinks like you or has similar experiences to you or looks like you in a field, that may draw you towards that field. So the stereotypical perception of a scientist, I think, can be create sort of an exclusive feeling to it and maybe steer people away from that who would otherwise be very successful or find great pleasure in working in that field.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest, Jason Brown. He's Director of Science and Education at Carnegie Science Center, talking about an initiative to help schools evaluate and expand the way they teach math and science. If you have a question, a comment, call 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM, on Twitter at ESSPGH. 412-246-2002, the number to call to join the conversation on the air. Are you someone who is contemplating a career in a STEM field? What are the questions that you have about how you fit into this profession? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. And we were mentioning the appearance you made before Congress last week. And Keith Rothfuss was there, Republican Congressman, Democratic Congressman Mike Doyle was there as well. They're saying that all across Pennsylvania, there are jobs available and they can't find enough workers to fill these positions. Why is that?
Well, I think the reason for that is because many of the students who are coming out of school haven't developed these STEM skills or 21st century skills, which involve things like teamwork and collaboration and problem solving and critical thinking and computational analysis. These are, with the rise of standardized testing and the focus on content, these are skills that have maybe been put on the back burner a little bit more in to lean towards taking care of the test, preparing students for the tests.
We're hearing that a lot, aren't we?
I believe so. And in fact, I meet with a lot of teachers, and I was a classroom teacher for a number of years, and there's a great weight put on test scores. But that might not be what's best for the students. My perspective is if you spend 12 years in school as a passive learner where information is being given to you that you then regurgitate back on a test, and then suddenly you're put in the workforce and you're asked to be an active participant in the workforce, you haven't developed those active skills. You've been a passive person who is used to receiving information as opposed to going out there and creating and innovating.
I'm trying to think if I've heard anybody who thinks it's a good idea to teach to the test. So if that's a problem or part of this problem, how do you get away from that?
That is the big question. I think there's gray area in there. It's not either teaching to the test or teaching all process skills. There's a balance in between, I think. But there are almost these two competing models in education right now. One deals with objective tests and educational accountability, and the other one is focusing on student curiosity and inspiration and inquiry-based learning. And it's very difficult, I think, for a single entity to teach both of those models in the same space, which is why formal education is so challenged right now. They want to do both, but I think that it's really difficult, if not impossible, to be done by one group. And that's why the Science Center is really trying to assist in that. We like to think of ourselves as providing a lot of the inspiration and the exposure to careers that students are looking for so that the schools aren't under so much pressure to do everything.
But isn't that the way it needs to be, that that the emphasis, I would assume, and you are you're someone who has STEM teaching experience, so I'm coming at this from a layman's point of view, but I would think that the emphasis would be better served if it were on getting the students to think about processes, to think about the science, rather than just tell me what I need to know so I can get it right on the test, and then it's out of their heads as soon as they've written it down.
Absolutely. That's absolutely what you need to do. One of the ways that, I mean, my experience in formal education, it's a very siloed model. So when you're in science, you learn science, and then you go to your math class and you learn about math, and then you go to English and you learn about English, and they're all very disconnected from one another. But I think as anyone in the workforce knows, that is not the case once you enter real life. So ideally, there's more of an integrated curriculum where the teachers are collaborating with one another and developing more holistic projects that take a little bit of everything. So they work together to develop a single, larger-scale, real-world project, some maybe based on like one of the grand challenges that this generation is really going to be faced with, and teaching to that from each of their content areas. So what the students are learning in science is supported by the math concepts that they're covering in their algebra class, for example.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what would be an example of a grand challenge that suits this generation, that suits the 21st century questions that are out there, problems that are out there?
Energy, healthcare, the environment, economy, climate change. There are many challenges that are sort of looming on the horizon. How are we going to meet the energy challenges of the 21st century while balancing the environmental needs? And that is one thing that I think a lot of students think about. And if you can bring that to them and, again, teach it from a variety of subjects, you can get some buy-in and you can get that inspiration. And if they realize that they have the ability to perhaps solve even pieces of this, I think that's a tremendous motivator to keep them moving forward and to lead them into these STEM fields, especially if you combine it by then exposing them to people who are doing this in their real lives.
412-246-2002, the number to call to join the conversation with Jason Brown. Let's go to Joe in Pittsburgh. Joe, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Joe? Oh, boy. Joe, you waited so long, and then only to have that happen. I'll tell you what, why don't you call us back, and we will get right to you when you do. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. And there was an evaluation process I mentioned that that is part of this expansion of the way that schools teach math and science. Explain this evaluation process, how it works, and what you're learning from it, or what you have learned to this point.
Well, the initiative is called the Carnegie STEM Excellence Pathway. And it was when we first opened the Chevron Center for STEM Education and Career Development in late 2011, a number of schools started to approach us and looking for a stamp of approval or validation of what they were doing in STEM. And after discussions with these individual schools, what we found is that there was a very nebulous definition for what STEM is. What one person perceives as STEM or one organization is totally different from what others perceive.
And again, STEM stands for?
It stands for science, technology, engineering, and math.
Okay.
And so part of the discussion that came out is, well, what is real STEM? What is real, robust STEM education comprised of? And so one of my colleagues, Alana Kalesa, put together an advisory group. And with some funding support from the Heinz Endowments, she put this group together to come up with a really strong definition for STEM education and then develop a rubric that would essentially allow schools to assess themselves in terms of where are they being successful in these areas and where there are some gaps. And then through this iterative process, they develop priorities for improvement and then an action plan that they can implement. And because it's an ongoing iterative model, they can track their progress and then each year reevaluate themselves and make plans for future improvement so they can – it's sort of a continual improvement process. So what we look at the Science Center in terms of how we define robust STEM education, we have four pieces to it. We have an inquiry-based science and math education, an integrated curriculum like I was describing before where different subjects are taught together. Project-based group learning where students are working together in teams to solve problems that are posed to them, and then this career awareness piece. So these are some of the pieces that have been fit into this STEM excellence pathway. So to give you an example, back in October, we had about 13 different districts bring teams to the Science Center, and those teams ranged in size from anywhere from about 6 to maybe 15 people. And the idea behind the pathway is that it starts a lot of discussion going. So these teams, as they proceed through this rubric, they can evaluate what are we doing in terms of curriculum? What are we doing in terms of our instructional practices or assessment? How about family engagement? Are we giving the students connections to what STEM openings are available to them in the future? And so as they proceed through this rubric, we can also set up a district-to-district mentoring process. So if there are two districts who have complementary needs, they can be teamed up and work together on them. Or if they have opposing needs, one district that may be very strong in one area can be paired up with a district that identifies that as an area that they would like to improve so that they can support one another. And this program really was only sort of soft launched back in early September, and we've done virtually no marketing beyond word of mouth. And so far it has spread to over 120 districts and schools in 7 states in the District of Columbia. So there's clearly a need for it, and there are clearly schools that are interested in it. And one of the reasons I think it's been so successful is it's not about throwing money at the problem. If the answer to, you know, what your school's needs are is, oh, all we need is $1 million STEM wing, well, that's great, but there are probably most schools can't afford to do that. So we wanted to look at something that was adaptable for schools of various sizes, various levels of resource. Do they have a lot of money? Do they not have a lot of money? Do they have a lot of students? Is it small? Where are they located? We wanted to sort of remove those pieces so it was fully adaptable. So this is useful as a single school or as a whole district. And it was piloted during the 2013-2014 school year in three districts in the region, Upper St. Clair, South Fayette, and Stowe Rocks. And each of those schools found great benefit in this. And, you know, some of those schools are very well resourced. Some of them are large. Some of them have fewer resources. But what they all found was that this STEM Excellence Pathway helped them to evaluate where they were in terms of what they're offering for STEM education and then identify areas that they could improve.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Jason Brown, who is the Director of Science and Education at Carnegie Science Center. We'll go to the phones now. We have Joe back. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. How are you doing today?
Good, sir.
Good, thank you. Welcome back.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment quickly that, you know, I went to a state university to actually be a tech ed teacher to, you know, generalize it. And, you know, a lot of my classmates, you know, my fellow students in tech ed who had graduated and got jobs don't have their jobs anymore because budgets were cut and, you know, they were the first ones to go because they weren't math, science, history, and language, English. And I, you know, I don't know if that's still going on, but personally, that was what put me in the career path, you know, my tech ed classes. That's what got me going and, you know, reasonably successful career because of it. And, you know, if that's not going to happen for our students now, then they're in trouble.
So what about,
I don't know if you see that trend continuing and how to stop it.
Well, I think that that career and tech ed courses are very important. And I was actually just speaking with someone earlier this morning and reflecting on when I was in high school. And just sort of by fluke, I ended up taking a small engine repair course. And it was incredible. I loved the hands-on nature of it. And even though I felt I was a traditional student who was traditionally fairly successful in school, there was something about that that I felt was just different than everything else in school. And it really – I enjoyed it, and I looked forward to that class. And I think that, you know, in terms of what individual districts are doing, I can't speak to that. But I think that there is definitely a trend that is focusing on primarily ELA and math to the detriment of other subjects. And I think it's probably done on a district-to-district basis. But I think that – in doing so, if CTE courses are being dropped, I think that those districts are doing a disservice to their students because not only do those reach students who maybe don't find success in other areas, but they really help to develop these STEM skills that employers and corporations and the workforce around here are telling us that they really need and want.
Joe, thank you for that call. 412-246-2002 to join the conversation. What ideas do you have? What ways do you think that math and science learning should be improved? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Jason Brown, our guest. Jason, you taught high school science, in fact, middle school, high school, and university science for 11 years. How did you go about it? What was your approach? And what were the things that you did that maybe deviated from the mainstream methods of teaching?
I don't know if it deviated so much, but what I tried to do was offer a lot of hands-on opportunities. So, for example, when I taught middle school technology with my seventh graders, we studied projectile motion, and then they built catapults and tested them, and part of their grade was based on their ability to hit a target that they put out on the football field. So they would launch golf balls and see how they could see what their ability was to have a repeatable experiment.
So see if you could hit the goalpost or something.
Yeah, well, it was actually a big like round tarp that we put out with a target on it. so that's what we did in middle school, and then when I taught construction management at a university in New York, and in building science, we would talk about all of the, you know, moisture control and insulation and all the different aspects having to do with how a building operates. And so the students, instead of giving them a content-based test at the end, they were given a hypothetical building that they then had to develop a remediation plan for. They had to price it out. They had to look at long-term payback, return on investment. And so it was I think the thing that I tried to do was it wasn't always about having the right answer. It was about arguing from evidence. So it was developing a plan to solve a problem, looking where they start, where they finish, and then identifying and carrying out the steps to get them from one point to the next. And in doing so, the right answer wasn't always just – there wasn't one right answer. It was, I believe this is the right answer, and then I support it with this evidence based on what research I have done, what my understanding is. So it's almost like using content as the tool to teach the process.
So it was about getting the brain, the wheels, and the mind to turn, and it sounds like your emphasis was more about the thought process and having young minds think about that process in a way that helps to develop their thinking as opposed to always looking for that one answer, especially when there may not always be just one answer.
Right. How do the pieces fit together? Not right. What each of the pieces are, but how do I use them to advance my greater understanding of a larger concept?
One last question for you. You know, one of the things that when those of us of a certain age were growing up that got us interested in science was the space race, the space program. How much does having a robust and vital space program help inspire young people to think about science?
Well, I think it's tremendously important, and one of the reasons I would say is because it's still such a frontier. You know, there's always further that you can go, and there's always more that you can understand. And science is an evolving practice. In science class, you know, there's this perception that we already know everything. But the idea is that the truth is that science is dynamic and it's always changing. And not only does space move that forward, but I think now going in the other direction too, like nanotechnology and miniaturization and realizing that there's a whole frontier universe in the other direction, not just to the larger but to the smaller. And I think there's so many breakthroughs and so many exciting things that are going on in both of those areas on an ongoing basis that really is a great way to provide that inspiration and to provide students an opportunity to really jump in with both feet and get excited about it.
Jason Brown is Director of Science and Education at Carnegie Science Center and an experienced teacher, instructor, who is talking about ways to teach STEM education. Jason, it's been a pleasure meeting and talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a great.
Coming up, one of the country's leading experts on social media strategy is speaking at Point Park this week. He joins us next. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Tomorrow afternoon, Point Park University will host a panel discussion as part of #BergAtPointPark. The event is a social media strategy workshop featuring a panel of local entrepreneurs and journalists, including WESA Morning Edition host Josh Rollerson. Headlining the event is Sri Srinivasan, one of the country's leading experts on social media strategy. He's taking time from his current position as Chief Digital Officer for the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York to join us on Essential Pittsburgh. Sri Srinivasan, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much. I don't think anyone said my name that many times in 30 seconds, and you got it right. It's very hard to get my name right.
Well, coming from a guy named Guggenheimer, it was the least I could do.
Your name means a lot in the world of art. So you're not just Guggenheim, you're more Guggenheim than a regular Guggenheim.
Well, I'll take that. You taught at Columbia for nearly 20 years. When did you first start teaching courses in social media? And was it hard to convince people that such courses were needed?
Oh, people would say, my God, you're going to teach a class in Facebook and Twitter? What's next? They're going to, you know, teach people things that they don't have, you know, that have no real use. What does this mean? And it's been fun to see social media become something real in people's lives. And it's sort of an evolution of what we've been doing all along. I used to do classes in the value of email, if you can believe it. In the mid-90s, people weren't sure they needed email. They said, we have the fax. It works so well. And I would teach people that you need to get an email address on your business card. And people would question me, like, why would I ever do that? Now, of course, we have email. Everybody puts an email on a business card. We might even think of putting a Twitter handle on a business card. It all depends on making this stuff work for you. Does it fit into your workflow and your life flow? If it does, maybe it's something you should think about.
And in those early courses, what kinds of things did you emphasize about using social media? You mentioned you should have your email address on your business card, for example. Were those things that you emphasized years ago the same things you emphasize today?
I think not much has changed. The technology has changed, but the goals of why we're using social and the potential is still the same. The tools have changed, but not the goals and what we can do. So a couple of examples is that we first used to force people to do email, and then along came the web, and we would teach classes in how to use the web. We used to teach people how to use Google, and people weren't sure that they liked Google because there were other existing forms before it, and then other kinds of sites. And then we started talking about blogging as a piece of technology, and then came social and LinkedIn and all these other things. And the thing to keep in mind is all of the tools may change, but the goal of social media is to connect with people and with companies in ways that improve the work you do or help you in your life in a better way. I used to teach folks the importance of email for connecting with grandkids, for example. And you don't need to make that case anymore. And in fact, the fastest growing demographic on Facebook are women 55 to 65, because they found a way to use Facebook to connect with their families and for other reasons. So it sort of slowly comes around, but it doesn't change that much.
And as I listen to you describe all of this, Sri, I wonder about how we've evolved. When you talk about email, it made perfect sense. It may not have at the time to some folks, but certainly in retrospect, it makes perfect sense that you would have said 20 years ago, this email thing, you want this. It's going to help you. But, you know, Facebook, I guess if you really want to open your life up, sure. Mm-hmm. But Twitter, I mean, do we really need these things, or is it just adding to the noise?
And by the way, it's going to get much noisier. There are new tools coming around that are going to make things much more complicated in our lives. All the changes we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years, we're going to see that accelerate and be even more complicated in the next 10 to 15 years. So I don't want to scare your listeners, but I do want to say that.
Well, you're scaring me.
The question you're asking is the right one about how do you know what to put your energy behind? And my way of thinking about it is that there was a point in 1998 where there was something new comes along, and it turns out it's Google. And now you say, of course, Google makes sense. But that's also the time when things like pets.com were around and people were throwing millions of dollars into that. And there's some worry that today we're sort of in that same bubble where everyone's throwing money behind all these new tools and gadgets and technologies. What we have to do as people who are working in today's world is understand the potential and understand the pitfalls because of things like privacy and confidentiality and security. These devices are taking over our lives and have taken over our lives. How do we adjust to them in a way that makes sense for us and keeps our sanity?
Will some of these technologies go the way of MySpace?
That's a great example, because MySpace was the hottest thing around. It was bought for $800 million at one point, and it was this big, very successful, unstoppable juggernaut until it was stopped. And I can give you another example. Foursquare is a much more recent phenomenon. I used to check in on Foursquare all the time when I would travel because I was looking for places to eat or what to eat in a restaurant, all of that stuff. And then they decided to what's called pivot, to try something new. And in that process, I don't use it anymore. That doesn't mean it'll never be useful or that it may not come back. But the fact is you can build a brand so quickly today, and you can also lose it just as quickly. One way to think about it is that it used to take 10, 15, 20 years to build a brand, and therefore you also had a much slower slope on the way down. Today, that's not the case. Today, you could build something quickly, and then it can just die as quickly. You have to be careful. You have to involve your users. You have to give them a reason to use you. and you have to make their life better in some way. If you don't make your life better, if it doesn't make your life better, you're going to just throw it out.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Sri Srinivasan, who is the former dean at the Columbia School of Journalism and also a full-time professor there. His current position is Chief Digital Officer for the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and he is talking in Pittsburgh at Point Park University as part of hashtag Berg at Point Park, a social media strategy workshop. With so much social media out there and more on the way, do we run the risk, Sri, of becoming disconnected?
Absolutely. I think, you know, in a way you can be over-connected and disconnected at the same time. We're seeing this as an issue within some families. People are spending so much time on their devices that they're not thinking about the life around them. And there's so much of what we call FOMO, fear of missing out in kind of all, you know, everything else that's happening, that you're not experiencing what you're not missing out on already. And we have to find that balance. And I are on the side of find the fit that works for you. Don't let anyone intimidate you into pulling out a camera and taking pictures of that sunset if you don't want to. But if you want to, there's certainly nothing wrong with that. In the museum, I work at the Metropolitan Museum. We're always thinking about these issues because people come in with their phones and we're encouraging them to take photographs. But we recently banned the selfie stick at the Met. And I say I'm pro-selfie, just not pro-selfie stick, because a selfie stick is like going in people's faces. And this is a way of kind of thinking about a kind of a middle ground. And that, I think, is good for everybody as they try to figure out this stuff.
What about the impact of all this on our attention spans? Are we losing the ability to really absorb and appreciate life at a more earthly pace, if you will, than the pace at which we're constantly checking our messages, our emails, you know, where do we go at the restaurant, the you know, the entertainment, all those apps, all that stuff?
Sorry, were you talking to me? I was checking my email.
Exactly. My point exactly.
This is something is happening to our brains when these notifications, there's a reason that the phone buzzes and the beeps, your brain responds. They've done studies where they're looking at the brain waves, and people are responding, and it gives you the same kind of triggers within the brain as other kind of very beneficial triggers. And so you have this feeling that you must kind of respond to this, like a Pavlovian response almost. And that's affecting the brain. It's affecting attention spans. There is no doubt about it. One of the studies showed that 90% of the world's data had been generated in the 2 years before 2013, meaning more than 90% of what had been generated throughout history was generated in those 2 years. And it's only going to get worse. We're approaching 1 trillion photographs being posted and things like this. There's so much content being created and consumed that it can be very overpowering. And we need discipline. We need to say we're going to – one of my friends recommends a detox of 2 weeks without the phone once in a while. But it's not possible for most people. If you if you're lucky enough to be in a job where you can turn off, it's fine. But your boss may not want you to turn it off. And I go back to 1997, 98, 99, in that period when the BlackBerry started coming into people's lives. And we could have said, hold on, I'm not doing the BlackBerry. That's the line I'll draw. I don't want to be available 24/7. We did not say that, and therefore we're all in this boat of being on call by our bosses. In Europe, they're doing things like no email after 6 o'clock. You're not allowed to ask a subordinate. You cannot email a subordinate after 6 o'clock. Those are things that they're starting to do. But I don't think any of that can ever be mandated or even requested in America.
I like that. No email after 6 o'clock. I'm sure you get asked this a lot, but what do you see as some of the biggest do's and don'ts of social media strategy for businesses, nonprofits, and so on?
My first rule is what's common sense in real life is common sense in social media. What that means is that we have to really approach this. This is not different from everything else we've ever done in business, but we have to be smarter about it and understand the technology. So a couple of do's and a couple of don'ts. Do really think about why are you on this platform? Is your audience there already? Are your customers there already? Are people who you want to reach there already? The other day I was asked, how come the Met is not on Snapchat, which is one of these disappearing, you can post something and it'll disappear, self-destructing messages. And I was shocked that anybody would ask why the Met would be there, but that's because a big museum out in L.A., LACMA, joined Snapchat. And you don't want to just join things because other people are using it. You have to say, does this make sense for my business, my industry, my customers, my audience? So that's one do. And then the other do is really do think about how you would do it in a sustainable manner. Before you jump into a platform, does it make sense? We ask that question. And then how do you actually do it? How will you keep it going? Because it takes some effort to start a platform, then to be good at it, and then to continue to feed the beast, if you will, because that's what social media is. It's kind of a beast, and it requires work. We've just doubled our social media team at the Met to 2 people, and I just feel like even they are so fully occupied and engaged that there are things that more people could do.
You come at this topic from a slightly different position as someone with a background in journalism and reporting. What are some ways you think social media has changed journalism?
I think it has changed it in ways that we could never have predicted, even people who consider themselves champions of this stuff. And in my own life, when Facebook came along, I was like, what do I need this thing for? I already have email and blogging and all of this stuff. Why am I using it? Why would I use it? And in fact, I didn't use it for a long time. Then I found that, you know, my family and friends were posting photographs, and it was the only way to understand what some of them were doing. And so I started using it. And what in terms of reporting and journalism and media, it has changed. It has been changed by the fact that people are now cutting out the middleman, middlewoman, if you will, in terms of the media, and going directly to their audiences. Athletes are among the most successful in this way, as well as celebrities. There were celebrities who hated paparazzi. Now they're posting their own photographs. They've become, they're kind of like, if you remember, self-deportation. There's like self-paparazziing that they're doing, and is kind of a surprise. So what do journalists then do? What is the role of journalism in social media? The role is to provide context, to provide analysis, to get people to see new things that they haven't seen before. And I believe that social media can actually help get your message out, but social media is also a great listening channel. Everybody thinks of social media as a broadcasting channel, but it's also a listening channel so that you can hear about trends, sources, ideas before other people. And that, I think, is going to be one of the reasons why social media continues to be popular among journalists and media types.
And can you give us a preview of the sort of things you'll be discussing in your talk at Point Park? What topics will you be dealing with?
First of all, I want to say I'm absolutely delighted to come to Pittsburgh. It's my first time there. And I'm a lifelong New York sports fan, but when I'm not cheering for, I'm a long-suffering Jets fan. I'm a supporter of the Steelers, and I'm so excited that Charlie Batch is going to be among the speakers. So that's itself exciting. And as a Indian American and a Hindu American, you have one of the great temples in America, Hindu temples in America, in your fair city. So I'm excited about all of that. And what I'm going to do is talk about ways in which you can become smarter about social media. How can you use it in your life to save time, money, aggravation? And how can you use it as a business tool to improve what you're doing and at the same time connect with people and make sure more people see what you're doing?
Sri Srinivasan is a former professor and dean at the Columbia Journalism School and is currently chief digital officer for the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. He's coming to Pittsburgh to give a special talk at Point Park University as part of hashtag Berg at Point Park. Sri Srinivasan, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, and looking forward to seeing Pittsburgh.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Friday was the first day of spring, which means it's time for spring cleaning. In addition to dusting your bookcase, clearing out those old clothes you don't wear anymore from your closet, the Pennsylvania Medical Society is encouraging you to take time to clean out your medicine cabinet. They've declared this week Pennsylvania Medicine Cabinet Cleanup Week, a time to go through your unused or expired medications and properly dispose of them. Joining us to explain the importance of medical cabinet cleanup is family medicine physician and president-elect of the Allegheny County Medical Society, Dr. Larry John. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So why is it so important to dispose of medications that we might have hanging around? What is the danger?
Well, I think safety is our main concern here, and it's safety from several points of view. Number one, drugs can especially be harmful if taken by persons other than those that the medicine is prescribed for. So in the wrong hands, many drugs can be quite dangerous, and we like to make sure that the drugs are being used by the people that the medicine was prescribed for. Secondly, drugs that are sitting around the house can provide a tremendous temptation for other family members and house guests, and we don't want people to be rummaging through someone's medicine cabinet and perhaps borrowing medicines that would be quite harmful to them and very dangerous for them to use. Also, sadly, many adolescents find outdated or non-used medicines in their parents' cabinets and tend to want to experiment or share these drugs with other adolescents, and the statistics of adolescents borrowing their parents' medications are quite alarming. In addition, we know that the FDA does not want to add drug residues into the water systems. The science on this is not absolutely clear, but we're concerned that the water treatment systems and septic tanks cannot sort out the low concentrations of drugs that can end up in the water supply, and even low concentrations of drugs can affect the health of people using the water supply. So
for
we're
that
very concerned from that aspect as well.
So for that reason, you're saying don't just throw old medications down the drain.
That's correct. We don't want any folks to flush or rinse down drugs through their commode or water system. We don't want these drugs to get into the water supply. It's very hard to get the drugs out of the water supply once they get in. So flushing can contaminate the water supply, and we strongly recommend not doing that.
So what do you do? What is the proper way to dispose of them?
Well, there are many community projects around everybody's local municipalities. Many of these drop-off centers are sponsored by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs. They're located throughout the list. They're located throughout the state. There's a complete list of locations that can be found online through the state PA US portal, and along that server you'll find proper ways to dispose of prescription drugs. If people cannot get to a site, or if they have drugs they want to dispose of before there's a semi-annual collection or a special project going on in their community, some suggestions that the FDA and the Medical Society have made would be, one, first of all, do not crush any of your medications. The dust from the crushing can create multiple problems. Number two is you can mix the medicines up in a plastic bag with perhaps something that would be undesirable for people to get curious about. For example, you can put your medicines in a plastic bag with coffee grounds or some salad leftovers that you may have used to prepare your salad, or some undesirable product that you'd be throwing away anyway. You can put in a plastic bag and seal it, and then put it in your general garbage. Okay. However, multiple pharmacies are more than willing to take back drugs that aren't being used. And you can go back and talk to your pharmacist. Many of the chain drugs offer a service where they'll take back drugs that are either out of date or not being used.
I wanted to ask about, and we have a couple of minutes left here, but I think what is really important to bring up is why people want to hang on to medications. And let's just say, you know, you're a dual income, no kids family. You don't have a teenager to worry about who might want to go rummaging through the medicine cabinet to see what they can come up with and share with their friends. Or, you know, you're not inviting people to your house that, you know, you have any reason to particularly distrust about going through your medicine cabinet and seeing what's in there. So you're not worried about somebody getting their hands on it necessarily. And you may want to hang on to some painkiller just because if the pain comes back, hey, I've got this leftover medication that I can take to get rid of that. People are naturally inclined to want to hang on to that stuff. So why shouldn't they?
Well, I think you bring up a very good point. We all know that some of these medications can be expensive. We all know that sometimes you have to go back to the doctor to get refills or to get a new prescription. So why not hold on to the medicines? Well, number one, a lot of these medicines expire. Their efficacy decreases after a period of time, and they may not work the way you want them to work. Number two, your own medical condition perhaps has changed. You may have had new medications ordered, and taking the old medications, mixing with the new medications, may not mix well. And without consulting your physician or talking to your pharmacist may lead to a bad drug interaction that you otherwise would not have appreciated. And three, sometimes people feel if some is good, more is better, and they can be taking the medications perhaps not as they were prescribed. And so it may not be worth saving a few dollars to expose oneself to the dangers of using a drug that's been sitting around for a period of time.
This is all
may not have the desired effect that you want to have, and you may be taking it for the wrong condition and end up with worse of a problem that you initially thought you had.
This is all very good advice. It is Pennsylvania Medicine Cabinet Cleanup Week. We've been talking with family medicine physician and president-elect of the Allegheny County Medical Society, Dr. Larry John. Dr. John, we are out of time, but thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I can't thank you enough for giving us an opportunity to talk about this important subject.
Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, we'll preview the Pittsburgh Humanities Festival. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.